Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm sitting across from Lee Sales. Talk about her book, On Doubt. I must say, I'm full of doubt right now. I'm facing Lee Sales in an interview. Welcome, Lee.
So you're in the position of power, though, because you're the one asking the questions.
That's what Fidler said, and I did not feel it.
I reckon it's heaps harder to be the person at the receiving end, the interviewee, than the interviewer, because when you're the interviewee, you have no control. The interviewer has all the control.
Yeah, but I felt the control. I lost my control when Fidler was involved. And Kerry O'Brien's been here, and he made a mockery of me. So I do feel that I...
See, they're both monsters. I'm much nicer than both of them.
I initially read On Doubt years ago. There was a little, I had a second-hand bookshop, and there was always copies floating around, and I could read those in an hour. And then added an extra bit to this edition, very necessary bit, I think, because of the changing climate. You were like Nostradamus in your first edition.
So it was 2009, I think, when the first edition of On Doubt came out, and basically it was about my concern that facts were being replaced by the rise of opinion in journalism, and I was concerned to see the way that I thought journalism was drifting away from, you know, facts and fact-based analysis towards just the vibe, you know, an opinion and whatnot. And when I reread it this year to then write an updated postscript in the Trump era, you know, the era of fake news, I just thought, oh my God, things are so much worse. Like, I just couldn't believe how much worse things had become. I thought they were bad in 2009, but oh my God.
Yeah, and as you say in your afterword, you know, it seemed quite tame now, that period of...
Seems like the golden days, yeah. Back then. Although, you know, then it was... That was sort of in the early... Fox News had been around for a while, but you were getting that first round of, you know, Fox News superstars, people like Glenn Beck, you know, who's now disappeared. And it was just off the back of the 2008 US presidential election where Sarah Palin had come to the fore. And so you were starting then, I think, to see the seeds of the stuff that we've really seen reach fruition now. There was a bit in it that really stuck with me in the first edition where in 2004, when I was based in Washington as the ABC's correspondent there, Karl Rove was George W. Bush's chief of staff. And Ron Suskind, who was a reporter at the New York Times, wrote this profile of Bush and Bush's reliance on his gut rather than on, you know, facts and analysis and whatnot. And there was a quote in this article, it was anonymous at the time, but we know now that it was from Karl Rove, his chief of staff. And Rove said, you know, people like you, meaning Ron Suskind and other journalists, you live in the reality-based community and you assess what I say against the truth. And while you're busy running around in your reality-based community doing that, we're building our own realities and we're creating our own empires, and then you'll study those judiciously. And it was at the time when this article came out, it was viewed as the most unbelievable Machiavellian remark, and everyone was like, oh my God, who said that? But now when you read it, it looks like Rove was just so prescient, and he just, you know, basically predicted what we've seen with the rise of Trump.
Well, I had the great pleasure of talking to A.C. Grayling the other day in his new book on democracy, and he was trying to, I think he's warning the world about the way in which the people, like the Russian thing, but also just interested parties can now get a message so specifically to tiny audiences and word it right for them, and so bring disparate people with different opinions together under the one banner of one opinion. Are you seeing that kind of thing in your analysis of what's going on?
Definitely, because with social media now, we can all broadcast to our own individual audience, and that message isn't filtered through the media. So if I'm broadcasting to, you know, to my individual audience, there's nobody necessarily between me and them to say, hang on, what you just said isn't true. So you look at, say, for example, the anti-vaccination movement, not based in reality or fact. Nonetheless, they've been very effective at building an audience and a market for their message, who sort of believe what they say because it feels like it has some sort of resonance with them. And so same with, say, if you're a viewer of Fox News or Sky News in Australia has started doing this with their evening lineup, you're sort of having, it's called viewer cocooning or niche news, where you're telling people basically what they want to hear and you're just ignoring facts that don't back what you're, you know, saying, or you're skewing facts to fit with, you know, your agenda. So, you know, I see it all the time in my job, for example. So If I give Bill Shorten a hard interview, it'll often pass without remark. But if I give a coalition MP a hard interview, certain segments of the press will say, oh, ABC biased. Yeah. You know, she gave Malcolm Turnbull a really rough go. She gave Tony Abbott a rough go. But then when I do the same for a Labor poll, it just...
Is that because they're just not even watching?
No, I think it's because it doesn't fit their narrative to say, oh, she gives everyone a hard time. It only fits... Because they've got this ABC bias narrative. It only fits... if I'm only giving Liberals a hard time.
So when you've got a point of view, you just don't ever move off and give any leeway whatsoever.
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah. So, which I find sort of disturbing, really, because to me it skews reality, because reality is not so clean like that. Like, you know, sometimes I might hold a personal opinion and there'll be some facts that are contradictory to it, and I don't think, be scared of hearing those and testing my own thoughts about something based on changing circumstances or different facts.
So let's return to the topic of the book, On Doubt. Now, you give tiny little snippets of autobiography in this book where you talk about a strict childhood, authoritarian dad, and your persistent why. It obviously there was a loving family that allowed you to actually say the why. It wasn't such a dominant male-dominant household that you couldn't actually do the why. But there was that why. Is that because some people don't have the why? Do you think it's something that was just built into you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think at heart I'm a gigantic sticky beak, and I think a lot of journalists are gigantic sticky beaks. And, you know, you find among journalists they like gossiping as well because, you know, it's just how they're wired. Yeah, I think I was just sort of a curious child. I always really liked reading. So I did have that sort of drive to understand things. I used to love advice columns when I was a kid, and, you know, sneaking in and reading Mum's New Idea or Woman's Day or whatever and reading the advice columns. So I've always been interested in that thing about the way people tick, you know, and why things are the way they are. So, you know, I love that idea that, say, for example, I was reading in The New Yorker yesterday this article about how you live with yourself when you've caused an accidental death. Mm-hmm. And it starts with this premise of a girl who's at university. It's 1977. She accidentally runs a child over and the child dies. And then it follows through the next 40 years of her life, how that impacted her. I love that, the idea that... because most people would think, oh, wow, wouldn't that be horrible if you did something like that? Oh, I can't even imagine how you'd live with it. And then you move on and you think about something else. I love the idea that you'd go back and actually... delve into that. I was thinking the other day about I did a live show in Melbourne with Annabelle Crabb based on our podcast Chat 10 Looks 3, and in the week leading up I was sort of thinking, oh geez, what if something goes wrong, because my mother had been unwell, what if something goes wrong on the day, and you know, because all these people are coming, like I have to do it now. And it got me thinking about people who do jobs where you have to be on stage every night. Like if you're a major Broadway star, like say Bette Midler at the moment starring in Hello Dolly on Broadway, you've got to go on every night because people have paid for Bette Midler. What if you're having the worst day of your life, still got to go on? And I thought, I could write a story about that. I could go and find some famous people and ask, tell me about the one night in your life when you had to go on when you didn't want to. So I've always had that sort of mindset of wanting to know what's really going on behind things.
Was your father like a training ground for you when you were every night you have to sit across from politicians and they've got an agenda and you've got to try and unravel that. Was taking on your dad as a kid like practice for this? Just trying to get him to admit that he didn't know what was going on?
I think our whole family sort of likes having a pretty robust discussion and argument back and forth. And so I think Mum sort of quite enjoys that too. So it probably was. I mean, I don't really know where that came from. I think all kids to a degree want to challenge their parents and whatnot. I mean, I notice myself now, I say it with my kids, they'll say, I want to do this, and I'll say no, and they'll say why, and I'll say because I'm the boss of this house and I said we're not doing it. It's like, oh my God, I've just turned into my own parents. Stuff that comes out of your mouth.
But if you explain, it's worse.
Yeah, completely. It's, just so much worse. Like, it's not a democracy, it's a dictatorship in my house. So I don't know if that was sort of necessarily that I was practicing on dad. Because, of course, when you're a kid, you don't know what you're going to end up doing in life, you know.
So we sort of, in this book, you sort of point out a few examples, especially of the politics of the time. But you also talk about the method, you know, so that there is a a line of intellectual thought that has been about doubt. It's been like the scientific method, Hume and his inquiries. There's a whole range of of different areas. Are these things that you picked up as you rolled, or have you also been drawn into those kind of philosophical questions as a reader and as a student?
Well, when I left school, I was really good friends with a guy whose family were former missionaries, and he was a born-again Christian, and so he invited me to go to his church with him, which I did for a few years. And I really wanted to believe in it because, you know, a belief system is a really useful thing to have in life. Like, I'm working on another book at the moment, actually, and I've looked a lot at the psychology of religion, and religion actually, even though I'm not religious, it's a very useful thing to have in life. If you have a hard time and you've got genuine religious faith, that's really helpful for you in terms of navigating your way through it. But my issue is that I just couldn't sort of set aside my own niggling doubts all the time to have enough faith to genuinely believe in religion, even though I really wanted to. And so I think that for me, I read a lot about doubt and apologetics and various things when I was in that phase. And so that sort of piqued my interest. And I ended up, I guess, coming to a view that if you had something that you believed to be true, surely it was only worth continuing to believe in it if it could stand up to being probed and questioned, you know, from every angle. And that's a bit what I try to do with politicians as well. Because I think if you're going to put a policy up, surely you have to be able to address any concern or criticism or hole in your argument. And I think people who do that well and who can actually, in a logical way, address a hole in their own argument and explain it, I think that's persuasive. And I don't think we see enough of it.
Why don't they hire someone like you to actually work in government, and then someone walks into it, instead of in front of the public, do it behind the scenes and see if a policy stands up? I mean, they don't have those kind of people.
I assume that they do, but sometimes I'm surprised by, because often I think when politicians come on 7:30, I don't think what I'm asking necessarily is really difficult, because when you think of my job, I have to be, I know a little bit about a lot of stuff because, you know, one night of the week I might be talking about economics and the next night I might be talking about North Korea. So, you know, I'm not an expert in anything. So pretty much every person who sits opposite me should know more about their subject area than I know about it. And so therefore I would think that the type of things that I'm asking should be fairly obvious. So, for example, I remember Malcolm Turnbull not that long ago announced a new citizenship test. And when he came on, the first question I said is, what's the problem you're trying to fix here? Now, that should be the core question for any policy.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah, and I would have thought that would be a very, very obvious question that you might preempt, but it didn't appear, I didn't think from the answer, that they had thought that that might be asked.
Oh, that would kill me. I mean, I've seen a couple of times where I've sat as a... I mean, people who I don't even like their policies or anything, but I've just been filled with such sympathy for them because of the way you've just shone a light on something which they have no idea how to answer at all. One of the things that drives a lot of, when you read a lot of modern popular science books or popular philosophy, is this idea of doubt and how important doubt is. And is it Karl Popper or someone who said that, you know, if you can doubt it, or if you can falsify it, then it's a good idea or something? That's around.
Well, isn't the scientific method that you put up a hypothesis and then you attempt to disprove it?
Yeah. So these kinds of things seem to be, should be central, seeing we're in such a technological age and science is so important. Why are we running a mile from it? It just seems like everything in current culture is running a mile from exactly what you've written about.
Yeah, I know, and it really disturbs me.
But do you understand why? Is there any sense of, is it that these interested parties are getting so good at it, or is there a lack of faith in us?
I think there's a lack of faith in major institutions. I think that, you know, the global financial crisis led us to believe that we can't trust major corporations, or say even recently the crisis with the Commonwealth Bank. Like, you know, the Commonwealth Bank is a brand in Australia, should be unimpeachable because it's such an old and established brand. And so then, you know, they've had this financial planning scandal, they've had this thing recently with the money laundering, and so people feel like, oh geez, you know, I keep my life savings in the Commonwealth Bank. I would have thought that would be, you know, the most reliable institution ever. Government, you know, people have lost faith in government. Media, people have lost faith in the media. And so I think when you find somebody who seems authentic in the manner that they speak, and they say things that resonate with you, then that makes a connection. So I think it's partly that people are distrustful of old established institution, so that's part of it. And then I think you combine that with technology, which makes it so easy to just do that and to build an audience around you. So I think it's a couple of things.
So the Senate is a kind of a reaction, that authenticity, the reason why we get Jackie Lambie in there. I mean, Sam Dastero is here with his memoir, and he's talking about how fun it is in the Senate these days.
Right. Well, as we had a story on last night about, you know, the, what are they calling it, Jacinda Mania in New Zealand, where the New Zealand opposition leader, Jacinda Ardern, looks like she might be elected. And there was an interview with her in the piece, and I thought when I watched it, it was really interesting because she answered questions quite... honestly, in a way that you don't normally hear politicians answer them. So the reporter said, how much have you been caught by surprise by this Jacinda Mania thing? And she said, oh, like, I'm really surprised. And then at the end, the reporter said, how would you rate your chances of winning? And normally a politician would answer that by playing the underdog card and going, oh, well, you know, I'm really happy with how we've gone, but we've still got a big challenge because, you know, Bill English is blah, blah, blah. And she said, pretty damn good, actually. So that was really unusual. And it was, she's got a nice smiley face, and so it was quite refreshing. She did seem like she had some authenticity.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, those kinds of whispers of truth of in this current environment, as opposed to the kind that Trump does, where his truth is just so ugly. There's got to be some kind of in between, you know, someone having ideals but being flexible with those and trying to change things for the better, and then someone who's just exploiting ignorance.
Well, the rise of Trump I have found very disturbing because it all of the thesis I lay out in this book, which is that facts are important and facts matter, and if you present people with the facts and treat them respectfully, that will mean something. I think the rise of Donald Trump has just blasted a gigantic hole in that argument because... I mean, nearly everything that comes out of the bloke's mouth can be disproved and discredited. And also his character, you know, he's a... I mean, I don't think there's ever been a political figure that I've openly described as, you know, a narcissist. But I think that that is objectively true. I don't even think that's a matter of opinion. I think that objectively you can say that man is a narcissist. And it amazes me that despite all of the sort of exaggerations and untruths and so forth that he has been able to get to where he is. Nonetheless, you know, somebody pointed out to me the other day, well, politicians have always done that. He's just a bit more blatant maybe than others. But yeah, that's been... I thought Americans wouldn't elect him. I knew that there was, from my own reporting there years ago when I saw all the seeds of this, I knew there was a lot of discontent, particularly in areas that were formerly prosperous and, you know, had manufacturing and the sort of arse has fallen out of it. But I thought, because Americans are very big on what it means to be an American and that the person who's in the Oval Office embodies the best of American values, you know, freedom and decency and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I just thought Trump was so far from that they would not denigrate this very revered office by putting someone like Trump in there. But I think I underestimated the extent of the anger and the disenfranchisement.
With journalism in this period, there've been some moments of cheering. You know, there's been times where journalists have stood up to Trump and said things, and even here in the Australian context. But with paper sales going down and with so much pressure right now, the government on ABC and on SBS the news spots on commercial TV looking under threat, money's been pulled out of journalism. Mm. As journalism as a career has also shifted, it's changing as to what the role is. How do we keep the bastards honest if we don't have journalists? Like, if there's a...
Oh man, I don't know. And I am worried about it. I mean, I hate to be sort of pessimistic because I've had an amazing career in journalism and I've loved it. But I do sort of look at it and think, oh my God, are people like me just going to become complete dinosaurs? You know, where will at a certain point every media organisation be coming from a particular ideological position? And I think as well, like, what if you don't... I'm just not very ideological. Most issues I don't really have that strong an opinion on. Some I do, but mostly I sort of see, oh yeah, I can see how that might work. Yeah, I can see how that might work. And so if somebody said to me, well, pick a side, I'd find that really hard because I'm just not that way. I'm not as tribal as what a lot of people in politics are. So yeah, I do worry about the direction, you know, that it's all heading in, the dumbing down of stuff.
Yeah, and do you know if there's any change within the actual training? Like, is there a shift in the way people are focusing on how you become a journalist?
I mean, there's a lot of emphasis now on the technology and how you do different things, you know. Whereas, of course, you know, when I was coming through, there was, you were cutting together radio stories with a razor blade, you know. So there's a lot of emphasis on that and doing multimedia and being able to do a bit of everything. I mean, I'm still, again, you know, because I'm a crusty old bag, I'm still big on, I think people need to be taught active writing and crisp, clear writing and, you know, writing for television as opposed
that
to...
That objectivity that is central to your book, is that something that's being taught or is that something people even understand?
I'm not sure, to be honest, if that's... taught now in journalism schools or if people, because there is, and I think this is a legitimate school of thought, there is a school of thought that says nobody's truly objective, so why pretend that you are? Why not just be honest and say, here's what I think, and now that you know that, judge my reporting knowing that that's my point of view. That is a legitimate, you know, way to think about things. I personally don't want to do that because, like I said, firstly, I don't have a strong opinion about a lot of things that I report on. And secondly, I just think there's so many people out there with an opinion. Like, surely there's some power in someone like me sitting there and not voicing an opinion and just interviewing people and letting it stand and letting viewers make up their own mind.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'll keep doing what you're doing. It's for me, it's very vital that there are the journalists out there like you who are willing to do that. What I found interesting, one of the points in there was this: the attractiveness of people with an ideal. Even though you pull back and you say, I'd rather be me, there is that sense, even with the early relationship with the Christian group, and then, you know, sitting across from someone who's just so part of the party and has that ideal. With you, it seems like you're immune to being overwhelmed by it. Is there power? Like, some things just won't get done unless a whole group of people actually believe the same thing.
Oh, massively. And, I mean, I, possibly because I'm not like this myself, I so admire people who have a real passion for something. For example, I every year MC this charity ball, which is run by a group called the Trish Foundation, which raises money for multiple sclerosis research. And it's run by a couple, Carol and Roy Langsford. Carol in particular does a huge amount of work. And their daughter Trish died of MS, and it was really awful. She was in her 20s, she had to be in a nursing home. Terrible. And so Carol has basically dedicated her life now to raising money for MS. And they run it out of the study in their house. Carol and Roy pay for all the administrative costs so that every single cent that people donate goes into MS research. They've raised $4 million, you know, on their own. And Carol is just so passionate and dedicated. And I just think, that what a legacy. Like, that's amazing that she has done that. And so people who care enough about something that they sort of throw themselves into it like that, you know, people who chain themselves to trees. Or I interviewed a priest for a Jesuit priest for this book I'm working on that's going to come out next year. And he talked about he'd spent 25 years on the streets of King's Cross working, you know, with the sort of most marginalised people in society, homeless people and all the rest of it. And then he got burnt out and he took a year off, and now he lives in, his name's Steve Sin, now he lives in Bathurst and he works with people who are being released from prison and trying to help them integrate into society. He was just the most incredible bloke. And I said to him, towards the end of our interview, you know, is there anything you regret about your life? And he said, without even a second's hesitation, I wish I wasn't such a coward. And I was like speechless. I just said, mate, you've worked on the streets of King's Cross for 25 years and now you live with prisoners trying to help them. That is about the least cowardly thing I could ever hear someone dedicate their life to. And he said, yeah, but mostly people think I'm great for doing that stuff. I've never put my life at risk by, you know, chaining myself to a tree or standing in front of a bulldozer or whatever. He thought because he hadn't sort of risked being a martyr that he had been cowardly. Mm. I just thought he was amazing. So I meet people like that and it just blows my mind.
Lee, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us. The book is wonderful. The little addition at the end, the joining things together and making it time and what's going on now is brilliant. Thank you very much for coming and talking about it.
Thank you very much for having me.
You can get hold of Lee Sale's book, On Doubt, at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.